Dr. Lee Merritt, how are you doing?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me. Well, it's morning here.
It's a pleasure. I saw a video, I think everyone has seen it, with you explaining something about the armed forces and the so-called vaccinations. Please tell us a little about your background.
Well, you know, I've trained as a civilian in medical school. When medical school was $7,500 a year, we thought that was outrageously expensive. It's a joke now. And took a scholarship, ended up spending almost 10 years in the Navy. And after I got out of the Navy, I did an orthopedic surgery residency. After I got out of the Navy, I just happened to be in Washington, D.C. with my husband at the time, and just served on the NRAC, which is the Navy Research Advisory Committee, where we look at defense technologies for the Navy. And by law, they had to have a physician on it. Kind of opened up my mind to some of what was happening in the defense world. And it's just been an interest of mine forever. You know, after 9/11, I really started studying bioweapons because of that anthrax and the anthrax vaccine. And just one thing led to another. And I feel like, you know, everything has been a stepstone to somehow end up in this war right now.
Yeah. You know, I came across 9/11 when it first happened. I thought it was real, of course. Yeah. I didn't have any doubt it was
real. We all did.
But in the meantime, I've been in touch with a group of lawyers in the U.S. from the East Coast. They've been looking into 9/11. They've been looking into the anthrax attacks. And the picture now is a completely different one.
Absolutely.
It looks as though this was used, 9/11 was used in order to keep up the justification for the, let's put it this way, military-industrial complex.
The
truth will come out. I'm absolutely convinced it'll come out. More and more people are catching on to what was going on back then. And it all plays into what we're seeing right now. It is maybe the backdrop of what we're seeing right now. How do you see that?
Oh, I think that's absolutely it. And if you go back in time to September of 2000, just before 9/11 next year, you know, there was a defense contractor. These are the inside Beltway boys that always look at defense issues. And they wrote a thing called the PNAC. We call it the PNAC, the Policy for the New American Century. And the idea was to look at how we can be in America the predominant military going into the next century. And one of the direct quotes from that policy brochure that I found was this. And it's pretty shocking when you think what they're saying. They say that, quote, advanced forms of biologic warfare that can target specific genotypes may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool.
Wow.
Now, these are not, you know, foreign terrorists. These are our guys. This is Wolfowitz and Kagan and Abrams and all the guys that sit on these boards and routinely, you know, pontificate about defense issues. And they're suggesting using, you know, genetic, racially targeted bioweapons as a realm of political influence. I think that's got to sink into people what may be going on here. And I think in general, you know, my other favorite quote is by J. Edgar Hoover, said the individual is handicapped by coming face to face with a conspiracy so monstrous that he cannot believe it exists. And that's, I guess I believe it. I think my only, you know, going into this, I might have been a little open-minded because as a fellow spine surgeon said to me one time, I think I'm going to start believing all conspiracies because statistically I'm more apt to be right than if I believe none. for me, the facts of the matter are that we have an international pharmaceutical company or cartel, essentially. These guys are the biggest financial supporters of politicians and of the media. So they fund, and then what people also don't realize is they may think the FDA is there to make them safer, but these guys fund the FDA. The FDA doesn't do studies. What happens is the big pharma companies develop a medicine or a so-called vaccine, and then they push it to big pharma with a big chunk of money that they pay them to use to do the oversight of their own research. You know, the pharmaceutical company does the research, sends it to big pharma, sends it to the FDA with a big check. And then, by the way, about 70% of the FDA, this was a study done by a couple doctors a number of years ago, are in rotating the revolving door so that they're going to or from big jobs at the pharmaceutical industry, six-digit figures, maybe seven-digit figures. So these guys know that if they don't regulate right, they're not going to get this plum job at the FDA. I mean, it's just so incestuous. And then to make the matters even worse, the CDC doesn't make money by really protecting the American public or the world against infectious disease. They really make money through their patents. You know, when I was a medical student in 1976 at the University of Rochester, New York, I was interested in becoming an internist in those days instead of an orthopedic spine surgeon, but I used to subscribe to the MMWR, which was the Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report that came out of the CDC, and it really taught you things. It taught you what diseases were out there, what the antibiotic sensitivities were in your area. I mean, it gave you useful information. This is before computers. It came on a little paper brochure. But now, you know, I was shocked that, you know, 5-6 years ago, when I would go to the CDC to look up anything, it turned out it was just a nonstop ad for flu vaccine. And it turns out that's what the patents for flu vaccine and other vaccines, I think they own over 56 of them, is what funds the CDC. So this is all about money. And the pharmaceutical companies are the biggest funder of the government, of the politicians. So essentially what they've gotten, this is beautiful. I mean, I would love to have a business where the government forces you to buy my product. So they now have a business where they have gotten government to force the whole world to buy their products and to indemnify them against any damage from their products. And that's the world we are in right now. And that they own their own regulatory body and their own cheerleading organization in the form of the CDC.
Could you just give us
happening.
What is the legal constellation again, like with regards to the CDC, when you say they are funded by these people? So is this like a, could you just explain to the audience what's the legal structure? So that's not a government entity as one would think?
Well, I will tell you, I'm not a lawyer, and my eyes glaze over looking to try and follow the money. But I have read that the CDC is on Dun & Bradstreet, and that is actually a private corporation. We don't think of it that way, but it does have its own funding source through these patents. So whether, you know, I'm not sure it matters whether it's a government agency on paper or not, but what I can tell you is there is a big incestuous relationship where money comes in for pushing vaccines. And when you're that should be, if I did that as a physician in America, I'd be accused. In fact, we have a STAR clause. I would be accused of conflict of interest. They'd throw the book at me. We can't even, as an orthopedic surgeon, we can't even own a physical therapy practice. Yeah. Separate from our own practice, because that's considered a conflict of interest. I might send people to my own physical therapy or my own MRI business. So, you know, it's completely not ethical, I think. And it does certainly should raise people's understanding that this is not about disease prevention. This is about profit for a lot of people and about jobs. I mean, I think her name was Julie Gerlingham, something like that. She was the head of the CDC when they pushed like the HPV vaccine on our young girls and on young boys, in fact, which mm-hmm. turned out to be a pretty good disaster. And where did she go after that? She became the head of the Merck vaccine, research arm. So that's what happens.
We have the same thing in Europe. The EMA is financed
right
by the fee. Even the European Patent Office is financed by those who claim for the patents, and they even earn money. If you contradict a patent, they earn again. So they have their own system. It's an island where you earn a lot of money, and it's run by pharmaceutical companies and Banda and other industries. And the ministers of justice, they just said, yes, we should have it, because in US they have it too. We have to be competitive. This is how they founded the European Patent Office. It's about money.
Right.
And there is no political control. There is no politician who can see the files or who may enter this. And you have the same in the WHO, where I was, when there was the swine flu, there was this the boss of this epidemiological task force. He went on and was the head of the development of vaccines with Novartis. So it's the same everywhere. You have the revolving doors, but you have it in military too. You have revolving doors. You told it, and it's not only in pharmaceutical companies.
Oh no, I know that. But there is a bigger. I don't want people to walk away and say this is all about money. I keep hearing that it's not all about money. There's a huge agenda here that transcends the issue of money, because ultimately, I think mostly thanks to you guys. I think when this all comes down, some of these pharmaceutical industries are not going to be around. I think that would be for the better. But I think they don't maybe realize it, because you know every totalitarian regime tends to eat the people that put them in power. And I think that's going to happen here. So you have to say, what's this really all about? It's not just about money. I think if you look back in time, and you can go back to Plato, the idea of depopulation, that there are too many of us little people that are waking up, and that in ancient Greece, there weren't that many people, but tyrants always think they're many people, too many people, and they get nervous. And we're, besides being nervous about the number of people that could be, actually exercise people power, we've got the issue of a world financial system that's on the brink of collapse. And I think that they see that the answer to this is a depopulation agenda. And I stumbled, I don't know if you've seen it, and I don't know if you've talked about it, but there was in America, there was a brochure that was created. It was a written document out of a meeting that was done by these, I call them the Uber Lords, whoever they are in the shadows that are running this show. In 1954, they met somewhere and they discussed the problems. And these guys, again, we don't know who they are, but they somebody took notes, and it got stuck in a copier that was found in a federal recycle bin or something. And it was called, and somebody made it into a book. And G. Edward Griffin, that's fairly famous, you know, about the Creature of Jekyll Island and various different research projects he's done. He told me he knows the guy that found this, that that's a real story. But it was written up, and he made it into a book called Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. And I actually had this on my bookshelf for years. And I thought they were talking about directed energy weapons, which are an issue. And I thought, well, that's a fight for another day right now. I got to read other things. But I pulled it out and read it on a plane not too long ago. And I realized, oh my God, that's really what's going on here. Because what these guys talk about is, what are we going to do about the fact that we have these people are greedy and there are too many of them? What are we, the Uber Lords, going to do about this? And they said, well, we have to have the silent weapons are not something we think of as weapons. They're weapons of social control. So in 1954, for example, they were talking about merging the data from credit cards, which who had a credit card in 1954, with the data from universal barcodes, UBC, those codes that we now go to the grocery store and they scan things. Well, I used to work in a grocery store in high school in 1969, and I can tell you, not only do we not have barcodes, we didn't have computers. So who knew about this stuff, right? And they're talking about metadata. Who knew about all this stuff? Well, apparently somebody did. And what they were saying is, we can merge this data and we can figure out, we can stress the economy like by artificially raising gas prices, and then through their purchasing, we can find out what all these little people are doing. I mean, it's that kind of thing. And they say that once they release these weapons on us, that the public will not be able to comprehend the weapon, that they won't believe that they're being attacked. They'll sense that something is wrong, but they're not technically able to respond because they don't know, and because it's complicated, it's highly technical, okay? This sounds a lot like this PSYOP, you know, pseudo-viral COVID, whatever we want to call this we're in right now, that the general public is not technically able to understand it and respond, and they don't know how to associate for defense. And ultimately, at the end of this document, they say they're, you know, we tried depopulating through wars, and that was messy and kind of screwed up the environment. Nah, we don't want to do that again. There's two options. There's benevolent slavery and genocide. I don't think they were kidding I mean, I think this is the kind of psychopaths we're dealing with. And I admit I might sound a little kooky, but I've decided I don't care at this point because I think we're in a really crux for humanity. And, you know, and Dr. Wodarg, I heard you early on talk about the problems of the, you know, the possibility of this vaccine damaging the placenta. And here we are now looking at our children being murdered and our, you know, the numbers that are coming out of that we can see, the numbers that honest physicians can look at and understand, the VAERS and reports out of all sorts of databases and all sorts of places. It's just undeniable if you have your eyes open and your heart open and you actually read these stories and listen to people. It's only deniable if you sit in some academic bubble and are being told by the CDC what to do. But if you go back in time, there's some evidence of how we got here. And that's also, I think, important for people to realize is that because I had heard about this and I hadn't really looked into it. We all know about the history in World War II of the T4 euthanasia program. And I have a thing on my website about the lessons of Karl Brandt, who was Hitler's chief medical doctor. And quite frankly, Karl Brandt was a good guy. He, you know, the idea that these guys were monsters just denies what really happened. He was a good guy that was an excellent surgeon and actually saved a lot of lives personally. But he went to the gallows because he signed the documents that allowed people to be experimented on without under coercion and without informed consent. And I would say that's exactly what's happening now. And if you go back to like 2000, it was 2003 or 2004 that the Royal Euthanasia Program really started. It was what we've heard about as the Liverpool Pathway in England, and it was funded by the King's Fund. It's an official agency, and this is their you know, euthanasia. We're the experts in America in the 1920s. You know, the whole euthanasia movement, and it then went to Germany and it went all over the world, but this whole idea of, you know, compassionately, you know, we always sell it. It was under, in England, I think it was the Marie Curie cancer care program and something like that. So we always sell it under the idea that, oh, there's these, you wouldn't deny these poor sick cancer patients in pain the chance to have a gentle death. And that's exactly, by the way, what they called it in Germany years ago. Well, so they started funding this program and, it became implemented early on. And the idea in 2000, so the last, that H1N1, I think that was 2008, 2009. So what they did was, this was the Liverpool Pathway, and it got to be generally accepted and pushed through the National Health Service. And it was the idea basically was to kill the elderly and the infirm. There was a Dr. Clive Seal, who he was involved in this, and he reviewed this, and he said that this pathway accounted for 1/6 of the deaths in 2008 or 9, whenever that H1N1 came out. And what they would do is very much what we're seeing now. They would isolate these people, and they would, if they looked like they might be dying, they might have some of the signs of pre-death, you know, they would then sedate them, kind of chronically sedate them, and withdraw nutrition and fluids. Now, I can tell you that's happening in our hospitals today. And what happens is if you have somebody with a mnemonic process that goes, especially elderly, that they're not able to completely oxygenate well, and their energy level's down, their immune system's down, and then you sedate them, you isolate them from their family and friends. This is a magnification of the death curve. Purposefully. I can't come up with another reason. And, you know, it's not just happening in our nursing homes. It's happening everywhere. And, you know, and so I think that's the big world picture, is that this is a depopulation agenda. And the fact people, I always hear that the argument against what we're saying is true is that, and I hear this from, you know, friends that are in medicine that are on kind of the academic, you know, blind side, I think. And they say, oh, you guys talking about all these deaths, it's a very small number compared to the number vaccinated. It's always a numbers game like that. They're not looking at the implications that we're in. You know, anytime you have a bad drug of any kind, it's like a little avalanche, like thalidomide. You know, it starts as a few, you start seeing a few, and then as it rolls down the hill, that snowball gains up weight and mass, and pretty soon you've got an avalanche at the bottom. And we're not there yet. But to not look at what's happening as we're killing people, like now through these vaccines, we're in the pre-avalanche stage, and we've got all these kids now with myocarditis. You know, in the military, I've got a friend in the military who can get to the epidemiologic database. And what I was told was that in 2019 and 2018, 2017, we went back 5 years, the average number of myocarditis patients were about 800 per year. Okay. Now, myocarditis carries a 5-year 50 to 60% mortality. You don't die right away necessarily, but your chance of living a long life goes way, way down. The year of the vaccine, and by the way, it didn't go up the year of COVID. So they can't say that the myocarditis was caused by COVID. Only 20 people in the year 2020 in the military died of COVID. 20 people in all the military services in the US. But in 2021, we now have, in the first 7 months, I haven't looked at the data recently, but in the first 7 months, we had 600 excess myocarditis cases. So we had 1,400 cases, and the year was just barely half over. Those numbers mean at 7 months into that, we've killed more of our troops, 20 times more of our troops than COVID did, statistically. Now, you know, NPR beat me up for claiming that, but I defy them to go and get these numbers and then look at it. It's they should be able to get it. So that's what I think is going on in general. And it's, you know, you guys have really looked at the science of this. I've been, one of the things I've been talking about over the last year are the lies that have allowed this to go on. I got into this because somebody asked me one time to go down and talk about the mask mandate. And I said, oh, this will be a piece of cake. 3 minutes we got? Oh, no problem, because everybody knows masks don't work for this kind of disease. It's never been shown to work. And it's not like science woke up in 2020. We've had OSHA, we've had environmental services, we've had, you know, big, big studies of masks. Yes. We know they don't work. Well, that turned out to be a falsehood because the entire University of Nebraska was stacked against me. One doctor on one side and the entire university boys on the other side, because they were following the CDC guidelines of what they're being told to say, I think. I would love to have one of them look me in the eye and really, some of these epidemiologists and smart infectious disease guys, look me in the eye and tell me that this idea you wear a mask because you're dangerous the first 6 feet of walking into a restaurant. But then when you realize you see the bar seat you're going to, you can take off your mask, go sit at the bar, or go sit at a table and eat your dinner without a mask. Now, you've put your dirty mask that you've been wearing all day on the table, put your phone on it, touched all the stuff and touched other people's plates. That's okay. But the minute you stand up, you're dangerous again. And then you have to walk, put your mask on to go to the restroom, walking by tables of unmasked people. I want one of them to look me in the eye and tell me that's contagion control. Are you kidding me? You know, I think a seventh grader in basic biology knows that is not going to control, if you believe it exists, an airborne disease. Okay, let's just at least go on that right away. Now, the other part that I wasn't so understanding of, because this isn't my field, I mean, I'm an orthopedic surgeon, we're not known for looking into this stuff, were these PCR tests. But that's even worse. I know that you've done a lot of work on this, and that's the worst. That's an unbelievable lie that, you know, you can't make this stuff up. And I can't believe how many doctors still believe in the tests. So, you know, we all know, everybody on the street now knows the name Kerry Mullis, and that he said that Fauci was an idiot and that these tests should never be used for diagnostic purposes. And he was dead shortly thereafter. But what they really don't know is exactly why he was saying that. I mean, the first reason is not just because they were overcycling the tests. I mean, we'll get to that. But the first reason was because these were not made for diagnosis. These were made for lab tests to find very, very, very minute pieces of genetic material. In other words, when done correctly, they're done under a hood. They're done in a sterile environment with people knowing and trained how to do them. They're very sensitive to, you know, mistakes. You have to do it right. What are we doing? We're swabbing because, and the reason for that, by the way, is because a small amount of airborne contamination can ruin the test. What were we doing? We were swabbing people's noses in the parking lots. You know, you can't tell me that makes any sense. So that's step one. And then the next thing is, and I looked at the Thermo Fisher instructions to how we do these tests. And they're very clear. They showed you how to make, there's a, such a small amount of material, you have to amplify it in order to even see it, in order to test for it. So there's a cycle amplification process. And there's a, they show in the Thermo Fisher guidelines this beautiful S-shaped curve. And they show if you cycle between 20 and 30 times, then you're in the sweet zone. And it's only qualitative. It doesn't tell you how much is there. It just tells you, is this genetic sequence present or is it absent? And if you do it 20 to 30 times, pretty much you've got a true predictive value analysis. In other words, it's unlikely to be false negative. It's unlikely to be false positive. Certainly not false positive. You still might have some false negative, but not false positives at 20 to 30 cycles, assuming all other things to be correctly done. But once you go from 30 to 35, you're going to start getting some false positives. If you go over 35 cycles, now you're in the complete trash zone where you're cycle amplifying dust and, you know, anything that blows by this test. You cannot, it's not only that it's just wrong sometimes or that it has a certain false positive rate, it's that it's meaningless, like a broken clock that gets the right time twice a day. It's completely false. And we to do it is just total, this is the one that really boggles my mind about smart physicians. We took statistics and we took some studies about how do you do lab studies and how you do quality control. And that's the other thing that boggles, that when people don't want to believe, this is what I tell my friends, if you don't believe there's a worldwide conspiracy here, okay, you guys that work in a hospital that are doctors, and you know those guys that work in labs, these lab managers in these hospitals that have the capability to do these tests, they're very smart people that are well-trained. They don't do false tests. I mean, if you had a test in a hospital lab that was 90% false positive, you'd fire that guy. So these guys know how to take a test. They know how to set it up. They know how to train their staff. They know how to do quality control. And yet what happened in 2020? Every lab in any of any size around the world was overcycling these tests. They didn't apparently look at the instructions that came with the test. They were given the booklet. They were on the average cycling 45 times. There was a lab, there were labs in Florida that had 100% false positive tests or 100% positive tests. And yet, you know, so then you have to ask yourself, there are two world views here. I'm sorry.
You can see with this thing that it's not about health. And it's not about truth, like in science. It's only about money.
Money and that they've been told to do this for a reason. That's my point is, you know, from a worldview standpoint, you have to believe. Now, it's not random chance that they did this, by the way, because on random chance, some of them would have undercycled the test if they just were stupid and didn't know how to do it. But the point is that not only did they do this test wrong, they all overcycled the test. And on that magic date of January 21st, 2021, they suddenly had an epiphany and all started dropping the cycle numbers down. Now, so either you believe that there was a worldwide psychosis of lab managers in 2020, that they all suddenly got some hissy fit and couldn't think about this one particular test, or they were told to do it. And when they, if you, you know, I think, I personally don't believe in the group psychosis theory. So if they were told to do it, who told them to do it? Well, it couldn't have just been the guy in Florida, the CDC guy, because, you know, it was all states, it was all countries. So by definition, it's a conspiracy and it's an international conspiracy. Somebody told them to do that. I don't have an, if somebody can come up with another worldview, I'd love to hear it. But
that was connected to the Drosten paper, you know, because there he you know, with the, like presenting this methods, new method for finding the virus, or like, I mean, finding that specific virus. And he, I think in the common Drosten paper, he suggested the 45 cycles.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, there were, you know, and you know, I'm obviously Dr. Michael Yaden and a whole group of other scientists, when they reviewed that paper, that the review of the Coleman-Drosten PCR protocol or whatever, you know, I wrote down some quotes here, and they're pretty damning. And this was, by the way, done, I think it was November of 2020. So this is 8 months before the FDA finally, you know, said, maybe we have to withdraw this test. Okay. But they said, consequently, in nearly all test procedures worldwide, merely two primer matches were used instead of all three. This oversight renders the entire test protocol useless with regards to delivering accurate test results of real significance in an ongoing pandemic. He said, these are severe design errors since the test cannot discriminate between the whole virus and virus fragments, the test cannot be used as diagnostic for SARS viruses. And then it says, this is a very serious area and makes the protocol useless as a specific diagnostic tool. They go on and on. The design errors described here are so severe that it is unlikely that specific amplification of SARS-CoV-2 genetic material will occur using a protocol of the Coleman-Drosten paper. It's not a small error here. And the withdrawal by the FDA was a level one, class one withdrawal. These were under emergency use authorization, just like these pseudo vaccines. Yeah. And so level one means it's a potential harm to the public. You should get rid of it. And yet what happened? People did not know about it. Most doctors didn't hear the news. You know, there was no big schmeary campaign. Oh, hey, I made a huge mistake, guys. Stop doing this. No, they didn't do that. So all these doctors continued to use it. And I think one of the funniest things, it would be funny if this weren't so serious, but I looked up because it says on the FDA site, what's their replacement? And if you go to the, and they say, see the CDC stuff, see the CDC site for this. I go to the CDC and it kind of redirects me a couple of times. And I finally land on this area that tells me to read about how you're supposed to do things now. Now, keeping in mind that they're now telling us, there was a Delta variant, and then there was an Omicron variant, which, you know, is nonsense. But anyway, this is all coming out. And it turns out state labs can't test for these things. And especially now when they tell you, this is literally when you get this whole two-page thing about how to do the replacement options for these now withdrawn tests. It sounds like if you've ever tried to put together something that you bought and it was, and the directions for the assembly were written by Chinese engineers, this is 10 times worse. It says things like, if you have a genetic dropout is what they call it. And it's like essentially a negative test. If somebody's sick, but you get a negative test, you should think Omicron, because that's probably Omicron, but it might not be. And if you have a double genetic dropout, think Delta, but it might not be. Because you can have all this and be perfectly normal too. I mean, it's complete gobbledygook. It's not English. It's not science. It's unbelievable. And I just challenge anybody to go read that.
The thing is, it might be let me look it up, from Star Trek. It may not even be Omicron. It may be... This is much more dangerous, of course, either the Borg variant or there's another one very similar. It makes absolutely no sense.
I like the Borg variant.
It's funny how they created the cases. They started created cases. It's all about cases.
Right. And that was another lie.
Something, what is a case? And then there was the narrative, and they made up the cases. They always had some cosmetics with the cases. They changed it a little bit, and they found out something very, very small, what even the laboratories in the normal state surveillance organizations cannot follow. So they made something. They did not test in the agencies. They did not give on the market. They just made up something, and each of them got a lot of money if they just followed it. A doctor gets
euros
if making this swab, and if he gives the injection, he gets 28 euros, which is a lot of money. And so they don't ask questions. They just said, okay, if I should do it, I just do it. And this is how the whole machine was running. And everyone who said, oh no, this is not right, what do you do? He would destroy the whole business. They would be angry, because they were all accustomed to it and they all followed it. And it's very dangerous now, or very, very difficult now to change this train going in one direction.
And I would like to share one little experience, one story that we, in the beginning, we were in close contact with a laboratory doctor, and it was like in some medium-sized city. And in that city, there was apparently something corrupt going on, because like two of the laboratories that were located in that city, they got all the test contract, basically some sort of contract. They were allowed to put some little center somewhere so people could go there and like get the tests. And so at that point, I spoke to this doctor various times, and he was like, he completely understood that it was fraudulent and that we were using these high, cycle numbers, and that it was not good for anything. And then, because we wanted to do some sort of collaboration with him, and when I checked in, then I was kind of a little bit surprised because he was not responding anymore. And, so I got then information that he apparently had been included into that scheme, So he was now also part of the doctors who got these test orders, basically. And he was making a huge amount of money, and immediately the question stopped.
Yes. I think that's when people ask me about why are the doctors not speaking out. I tell people, there's a pyramid here of power. And on the very top of the pyramid are the people that took the money to keep their university programs afloat. And, Fauci, this whole idea that Fauci's the ultimate bad guy, he's just the bag man. That's a mob term. And the bag man, it's not his money. He takes the mob boss's money. He distributes it to the capos, the guys that do the work. And then if they don't do what he says, he goes out and breaks their legs. Well, Fauci's equivalent was he took the big guy's money. He $800 billion, I've heard estimated, that went around to all these universities over 40 years. I mean, university hospitals, government agencies, all these things, lavish funding. And they overbuilt based on that. And so now if they don't do exactly as the CDC guidelines and he says, they'll go down. So they're bought. You can't get them out of the system. They've sold their souls for this. At the bottom of that pyramid are the poor, and I have a family member in here. I feel so bad for these guys because they're victims. They're the people in training. They're the medical students, interns, residents, fellows. They're people that are being forced to take this vaccine to keep something that they've worked their whole life for. That is so evil, I can't even tell you how bad that is. And they've changed their own genetics just to keep this job. And then in the middle, though, are these guys that are out of training that could leave these institutions and bring this whole thing to a halt. At one point, I was a big spine surgeon, and I contributed a great deal of income to hospitals. I know how this works. If 10 big surgeons at a hospital, or 20 big surgeons, I mean, the guys that really bring in the income to those institutions just said no and said, stop this or we're leaving, this thing would grind to a halt. And to not do that is, not an ethical stand. I mean, you can't stay in these institutions where they're killing people by omission and commission and call yourself a physician of some ethics. And I always said to myself, looking at what happened to Carl Brandt, because Carl Brandt was like me, they didn't call him orthopedic surgeons back then, but he was an orthopedic surgeon, did spine surgery and did trauma. And I thought, that's how I got reading about him. I found out, oh my gosh, Hitler's doctors, it's always the spine surgeons. We're always the ones doing crazy things, Well, it turned out he wasn't what I expected to read about. He was actually a good guy, like I said. But I said, what was his fault here? He was trying to do triage on a whole country medically. But at some point, he should have realized he was in a system doing evil things, and he needed to get off the bus. And I gave this lecture, it's on my website, 20 years ago, and I said, will we as physicians someday in the future know when to get off the bus? And apparently not. That's really, we're riding this bus. People are riding this bus over the cliff. And so for doctors, I would say there's never been a better time to get out of the system than right now, because you can independently through telemedicine treat people and help them. And you can make money doing it. You don't have to lose your house and your whole income. I mean, there's no excuse for this at this point, I think.
You know why big companies don't want unions? They don't want to unify the laborers or the people who work in the company. They don't want that they speak about such things, because when the pressure comes from above, the people who have to follow, they are much stronger when they have a union, when they come together when eating or when they meet somewhere and they speak about it, and they will exchange their views, and they will suddenly can unite to say, no, we don't do this. And
right.
They go and say, we have this in Scandinavia. We have 80% of degree of organized people in the companies. In Germany, it's about 20%, and I think in other countries, it's even less. There is no organizations, and Amazon, for instance, doesn't like unions at all. They don't want them in their enterprise. They fight against the unions, and this is only functioning when the people who work don't come together, don't unite, don't discuss what's going on. And I think this is very important that we have unions, that we make.
Well, the only problem, and I say this from the American experience, the only problem with unions is they may start out okay, but they can be co-opted by the bad guys as well.
That's right.
And the AMA, which is not technically a union, is a perfect example how it may have started out as a bunch of doctors getting together to share intellectual things, but it became you do it the way we say, or you're no longer practicing standard medicine, and we can go after you with medical boards and all that sort of stuff. And we know about unions driving people to for political purposes and things like that. That's the only problem. But you're right. People need to organize. And actually, they're doing quite a bit of that. I think it's good that they're organizing together kind of on the sidelines. Look at what happened to the Southwest Airline guys. Now, they were former military. They were patriots. They believed in the Constitution still, that they took an oath to defend. And they just said, we're not doing this. You know, the 35 or 37 SEALs. You know, I mean, I knew some of those guys like that, and those guys are serious, you know, thinkers. They're not just muscle, and they came, you know, and they stood up and said, no, you know, we're supposed to be defending a nation to allow religious freedom. Don't tell us we can't have religious freedom. So I think it's happening, but I'm not so organized union thing, because I've seen it get perverted in my country, but not all bad, but not all good either.
I just left the big union. I was a member of a big union in Germany. I just left it because the union didn't care about what's going on. They didn't protect the workers.
That's the press line.
They were just somewhere above with the government.
Yeah, they were co-opted by the government, yeah.
Yes, and they were where the government is. There is the money and all those people who are buying them. But I mean that the people in the hospitals, in the offices, that those people should talk to each other, that they should feel strong,
right,
that we help them to go on strike if they don't like to do what they are forced to.
Yeah.
Well,
when
you were saying, unions can be co-opted, that is the infamous Jimmy Hoffa example.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
I saw this movie. The thing is, things are happening anyway. Despite the fact that there may be not enough unions, we have just founded one. Our Austrian colleague, Dr. Brunner, has founded one. And the most important section in both these unions is the medical community, because we're going to use them as a kind of a crowbar to bring the entire system to a halt.
Awesome.
They have said in Austria, and both in Austria and here, there are many members of the medical community who said, if they do introduce vaccine mandates, we're going to walk off our jobs. But they need protection for that, and that's what these unions are there for. So we're going to use them as a crowbar to bring the system to a halt and to show the other side that we're the people who are going to call the shots, not them, because this is just a few hundred or maybe a few thousand psychopaths on the other side. But things are happening now because
we're
changing all these news. We're exposing everything. And through, for example, the testimony of two former WHO employees or advisors, we have learned how they managed to get the cases when they didn't have any cases. Now, regardless of whether or not they're gain-of-function experiments, regardless of whether or not this is part man-made or whole man-made virus, what we do know is the virus is no more dangerous than the common flu at 0.14, 0.15 infection fatality rate, and the immune system is perfectly well capable of dealing with it. That's why they didn't have any cases. So in early 2020, they needed cases. How did they create the cases? Well, they called Drosten here in Germany, Professor Dr. Drosten, who's neither a professor nor a doctor. He's a complete fake and idiot. And they told him to invent this test. And that's what he did. What Brilliant. They didn't know is that he was so stupid that in 2014, he had given an interview in a German business weekly expressly stating a positive test doesn't mean a thing. You can be perfectly healthy. And all of a sudden, he comes up with this test claiming this is the test that will tell you everything about infections. For some reason, we know why. We know that in the meantime, one of the most important things that we have to keep in mind, and it's the financial industry, it's the financial mafia who is behind this. This is how these very few super rich people funnel their money through BlackRock and Vanguard into the global corporations and control everything. So it's a financial mafia who we have to keep an eye on, because they're the ones who should have gone down in 2008 and 2009, you know, this predatory lending shit, but they didn't. Instead, right. They printed money. And they needed to divert our attention from their imminent implosion in September of 2019. And that's how they were pushed into an early start with this pandemic. But the pandemic doesn't exist. Is this right. a PCR test pandemic? So what did Drosten do when the pressure was there? And they changed their narrative overnight. Remember all of the American politicians, the German politicians, all the doctors, everyone saying, oh, this is nothing to worry about. Nah, we don't need to take any special precautions. No masks are necessary. And all of a sudden, it's the other way around. They asked him to come up with the test. Not just that, but the other part of the equation is asymptomatic infections. Of course, everyone knows there are no asymptomatic infections. They don't play a role in all of this. But he came up with this, and his ideas were then recommended by the WHO, which is completely controlled by psychopaths like Bill Gates, to the entire world. Had it not been for asymptomatic infections, nobody would have been afraid of anyone. So he comes up with that thing. Everyone is afraid of everyone. But then he calms us down by saying, I have this test, and I can tell you exactly who is infectious and who isn't. You explained it to us. Dr. Mike Yeadon, who's going to be with us any minute now, he has had taken a really close look at this, and he came to the same conclusion. Of course, the test, just like Kerry Mullis said over and over again, it cannot distinguish between dead and live matter. It doesn't even look at whole viruses, only at fragments. And the way it was set up, it was guaranteed to produce 100% false positives. That's how they created the cases, and they needed them for the declaration of the public health emergency of international concern, and they needed that in order to use untested new drugs, these so-called vaccines, on real human beings, which otherwise wouldn't have been possible. So that's the whole story right there, and that's how we're going to get them.
Well, and I think the other point to be made here is they may, you know, the biggest lie may be even another step, and that is that we keep talking about viruses, but keep in mind, we don't have true isolates of viruses, not just for this, but I couldn't believe that. I listened to Andrew Kaufman and Dr. Cowan and Stefan Lonk and all these guys, and I said, are you kidding me? After a year of hell, we don't have a virus? But it turns out that, and it's very easy to fool people because it's a complicated technical point. But the bottom line is that the viral genomes that we have for this, what they claim is the genome of SARS-CoV-2 only exists in silico as a computer programmed genome. And, you know, I heard somebody say this, and I think it's pretty cute, and I'm going to start adopting it and plagiarizing it. And that is that this is what really separates, you said it, it gets human beings to fear each other, which is a perfect way to control a population by having them be afraid of each other rather than afraid of the controlling mechanism. And what they've done is created these little fake mythical flying unicorns that make us sick. This whole concept of disease become that somehow I have these things that I breathe out that nobody can see and nobody's ever actually isolated, but we are sure that they are what causes disease, and that when I go into and stand next to you, I breathe on you and you get sick. we were taught that. I believe that in medicine, you know, forever. But you know what? It turns out when you really look at what's been going on, we don't have evidence for that, including in 1918, where they could not prove transmission. And they did a lot to try and prove that. People need to go back and look at that. They had people that were dying or very, very sick with the 1918, quote, pandemic of influenza, breathe on volunteers. None of them got sick. They had them, they took the, you know, for lack of a better term, snot and goo out of the lungs, and they put them into these volunteers. That didn't do it. They literally even spun that stuff down and injected into volunteers. It didn't do it. And the other thing is that the horses were getting sick back then. Now, influenza does not come from the term of some Latin for some virus. Influenza just means influence. And if you really go back in time, it seems like, and the horses, by the way, they couldn't prove transmission either. They put, you know, bags over their heads, got the goo, put it on other horses. None of them got sick. What's going on here? We see that with this. We see people. So when I hear, one of the problems of saying it's no worse than the flu for people on the receiving end that are really getting sick, they say, wait a minute, my relative just died. It's really making people sick. And I do see, as a treating physician, I see people that are younger having worse problems than I've seen in the past, but I'm, you know, for me. However, what we don't know is what's really causing it. And people need to understand that we haven't proved transmission. We don't have a virus. We don't have a test. We don't have autopsies. What we have is a syndrome of symptoms, the symptoms being, you know, flu-like symptoms, but nothing that's pathognomonic, nothing that's really characteristic of any one disease. And at the end of the day, there's several things that could do this. One of them, a lot of things that we might think about as transmissibility that might look to us like transmissibility really aren't. And I think Dr. Cowan goes over this very beautifully in his book, Contagion. He talks about the fact that if you don't know what radiation is, if you hadn't discovered uranium and Marie Curie and all that, and you send people down into a mine and they start getting sick, it would look like they're transmitting to somebody, each other, a disease. And you pull them out of the mine and some of them die, but some of them get better. And you think, oh, well, that was a disease. But it could have been that there was contamination with radium or uranium or something down in the mine. Now, we understand that kind of ionizing radiation now. What we don't appreciate, and because we've been lied to in the same way we were lied to for decades about the damages of cigarette smoking by the AMA, for example, is EMF, is non-ionizing radiation. And there's a ton of, when people choose to look, there's a ton of evidence. So it turns out the symptoms of COVID could be produced by cellular type EMF toxicity, by graphene oxide toxicity that we know is in these so-called vaccines that are really, the FDA has called viral-based genetic therapies, and by an artificially created spike protein that was made in a lab. We know that. I think anybody to deny that at this point is not in reality here. So, but we don't have is evidence of this little flying unicorn we call SARS-CoV-2. So I'm thinking we're being distracted from a big problem here, and that's the EMF.
No, we have evidence that there are many unicorns flying, and they are flying for thousands of years, and we know them, and they enter us, and we live with them. This is what we know. We know that they replicate in our cells. Yes, we know. But the causality, the reason why we get ill, this is a multifactor right. thing. And there are so many things coming together. And the thing, what makes us ill is our immune system, which is right. reacting with us. You know, there are, even when you walk through the meadow and you're allergic, there's nothing dangerous. But if you're allergic, you get very, very ill because of only just some flowers that are growing there. So it always has to do with the biological, in the biological system, there are things we are used to and we can digest very well. And there are others we react falsely. And maybe that we react falsely has to do with what we have trained or what we have eaten or what we, other or medicaments or
right. It's toxins.
Yeah, so many, there are so many reasons why.
I mean, we can call them viruses, but we're really talking about toxins here. And I think one of the eye openers for me was that study done in Florida where these guys, the parents of these kids, they washed their cloth masks and the night before, and then they sent them to school with these clean cloth masks. And then when they got home, they sent them out for culture. And it was shocking what this cultured out. It cultured out tuberculosis. You know, I expected them to culture out mouth germs. But what we found out, they cultured out tuberculosis. They cultured out Neisseria meningitidis, the bacterium that gives you Neisseria. They cultured out E. coli, from food. They cultured out things that we would not have predicted. I would not have predicted. So it's not that we don't have these things flying through the air. It's that the idea that disease is produced because I have a new one that you haven't been encountered with, and I give it to you somehow because I'm close to you, that's just an anti-human agenda. That turns out not to be true, in my opinion, at all. We've accepted it, but we need to rethink, like you say. It's our immune system, it's toxins. There's a lot of different things that make us sick. And I can tell you, in my city, people that had what looked like, which I thought was COVID before, and there's never been, when this whole thing broke out early, like the Chinese, they said there's nobody getting reinfections. Once you get it and you're over it. And the senior geneticist in Moscow in the Karolinska Institute all said by May of 2020, 30% of their people are already immune when they did very sophisticated tests. What's happening when we're getting these sicknesses now? And I can tell you, in my city, it looks like it goes right up the street where they put in the 5G towers. I can't prove that yet, but this is not something we should be ignoring, because that could be a real killing field. 5G is a directed energy weapon.
We are living beings, and life is communication. And when we communicate now through internet, and it's very complicated. If you tell me something horrible, maybe I get sick, although there is no direct contact. So life is about communication, and a virus is a material thing that communicates molecular informations. We have this in our body 1,000 times, and we have this between persons. We exchange substances, we exchange biological informations, and our immune system understands it and says, this is important, this is not important, and so on. This belongs to me, this doesn't belong to me, defend it. And such process of communication is always going on. And it's on the social level. And if we are anxious, if we are afraid, our immune system doesn't function really well.
Right.
So the same information one time doesn't hurt us. But if we are afraid, maybe it hurts us. So it's so complicated what's happening that we can only estimate, and that we can only try to define situations where people have died and why they have died. We make explanations, but it's very, very difficult to say a diagnosis even. What is a tuberculosis on one person is something else on the other person.
One of the things we can say, though, is that where the vaccine goes, disease follows. Exactly. And I think it's very interesting of what's happening in the South Pole right now with the Belgian contingent. Here's a group of people that are my friend. When I was in the military, my friend was one of these guys that was a doctor that wintered over in the American South Pole expedition. So multiple countries have these. And it's a couple dozen people or whatever that go down there, and they're completely cut off. They don't get supplies for a while because the weather's so brutal. They winter over. They go down there. So these guys were fully vaccinated. They were PCR tested to death. I mean, they were screened, so they didn't have any kind of evidence of having COVID, whatever we want to call that. And they went down to the South Pole, and now two-thirds of them have COVID, whatever they want to call it, however they define it. So how did that happen? They're not getting communication from the outside world. So they're not seeing other people. Why is it that the most vaccinated countries are having the biggest outbreaks of these so-called variants? Well, we have this is a brilliant idea. We have a toxic nanoparticle that was created in multiple labs, the Wuhan we always name, but there are multiple labs involved here. And that toxic nanoparticle, like the Prashant Pradhan and those guys, that's when I figured it out in February of 2020 when they published their paper and were immediately censored. But they showed that this thing, unlike any other coronavirus, if we want to call it that, out there, had these four HIV inserts put into the spike protein. And that you don't need all these, the rest of this huge virus doesn't even have to exist. All you need is this 181 base pair spike protein to make people sick. So it's pretty clear to me that was made in a lab. So then we have, if we decide that that's a bioweapon by definition that was made in a lab, then we have a vaccine program that is actually designed to make trillions of this very spike protein in your body. And we're surprised that now people are getting sick from it. I mean, I think that's one of the realizations that people, you know, that's the biggest tragedy here, because not only are we killing people with this, but we are inflicting them with artificial DNA and RNA that MIT now admits can be intercalated into our DNA permanently. So,
if it would be in each vial, all people would be sick. And they were planning it that it's not in each vial, but they dosed it. They gave it in some vials, in some
right.
in some batches, and not in others. We will hear about this from Mike Eden soon.
Right. I mean, you can see that in the Pfizer, the guy that put out the lot number versus toxicity, and yeah. you can see it's a dose response curve. They're experimenting yeah. on us with this whole thing. So, yeah. I mean, that's really an ugly. It's an ugly scenario, but I mean. It's a huge, I mean, if we've really given this to 40% of the children, we're in real trouble here going into the future. And, you know, I'll tell you, I appreciate everybody speaking out, but it's, I wish some people had spoken out 8 months ago. You know, Michael Yeadon was one of the people, you guys were one of the people, yes. but there are people that are coming on the scene now saying nice things, but they didn't stop this when they could have stopped it. And I will just tell you that one of the, when you look at, you know, premeditation, one of the things that I became aware of looking at bioweapons is that they always, since the time of the Kuomintang, they've always couched bioweapon research under the guise of veterinary research. And one of the things I found was there was an article called Self-Disseminating Vaccines for Emerging Infectious Diseases. And when you look... Yeah. So when you look at that article, basically,
you know, there are two vaccines now in clinical studies which are self-replicating.
Right, and that's what this looks like. It's happening to this one because what they. But the creepy part about this is that they also came up. I mean, this is for people that don't know. I mean, what they did is they wanted to get rid of. Apparently, there's these big mice outbreaks in Australia that just occur overnight. So they wanted to decrease the mouse population. So they captured a bunch of these mice. They injected them with these self-disseminating vaccines, and then they sterilized the mice by killing the female ovaries. Then those mice went out into nature and they shed on other mice. It's not apparently airborne. And that's a point about what's happening to us now. It's by contact. So they shed on them and then those mice became sterile. And then they shed on yet even a bigger group of mice and they became sterile. And then it kind of petered out in the population. And if you look at how those self-replicating immunogenic contraceptives, they're called, how they work, it's built just like the J&J vaccine. Their DNA, these were DNA vaccines that were made out of what they call a replicant deficient species-specific virus.
Yes.
And it was meant to shed and to cause problems with other viruses. And they have another paper about the numbers. If I want to decrease the animal population by this percent, and I know the birth and death rate, this is how many people are... That was a Freudian slip. How many animals I have to capture and inject in order to have it go through the population and sterilize and decrease the population by this amount? To me, that's a very worrisome study, especially when you marry it up with a Japanese study that was done on pharmacokinetics. And it showed that these agents, which everybody in vaccine research must have known about, the people that say they thought it stayed in the arm have to be lying. And it showed that these things distributed 64 times in the ovary versus the skeletal muscle. Why do I say they have to be lying? And I'm sorry to say that, but either you've been, I don't think you could be this clueless if you were really involved in the development of this stuff. Because once in February of 2020, and like I say, I'm not involved in virology or any of this stuff, but it was easy because I can read science. I went back and I looked when they started talking about vaccines, I started looking about the basic science, how they were doing this. And at that time, the Novavax site, Novavax makes this lipoprotein coating that houses the DNA, that's the genetic component of this. These were developed to be genetic therapies and oncolytic therapies. In that regard, you can't have them just sit in the arm. And you also can't have them just randomly go places. They have to be targetable. And Novavax, they call it the beautiful, you got to love this name, this lipoprotein coating that they've developed is called Matrix M. And they bragged about how it was targetable. So We have a targetable agent that goes to the that now is going to the ovaries, and that is very similar in construction to this depopulation of mice agent that was done for these emerging infectious diseases. And to take it down the rabbit hole one step further, I will tell you my belief now, having read all this stuff for a long time, I don't really think emerging infectious diseases exist like we thought they did. I mean, when I was in medical school in 1976, we talked about tropical diseases, but we didn't use that term emerging infectious diseases. That all started with this whole Ebola, HIV, all this stuff coming out of the jungles in Africa in the mid-80s. And what was happening then? There was Project Coast in South Africa, and that was a bioweapons program that was targeted at the Black community that we had people involved with. Larry Ford from Los Angeles specifically, who's dead now, a lot of suicides around this. But through the Truth and Reconciliation Committee of Desmond Tutu, we've learned a lot about it. And they were developing genetically targeted, racially targeted bioweapons. And they were testing it on the Black community. And that's when all these so-called emerging infectious diseases came out of Africa. And it's kind of after we signed the bioweapons treaty that Nixon signed, and we got it across for 176 companies, and we theoretically shut down our stateside bioweapons program. But did we offshore it? I mean, I'm just saying there's a lot of things that have been going on that when you really put this all together, this didn't start 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it started 40, 50 years ago. And it's built on a bunch of lies, and it's built on a bunch of basic science that's still out there for people to look at.
You know, if you can offshore torture, you can offshore that too.
Offshore what? I'm sorry.
Torture.
Yeah. Torture. Yeah. Of course.
The detention camps all over the detention camps all over the world, and there's such stuff. We have learned about this in the Council of Europe, and it's horrible. Just find a place where there is no one watching and do it and continue doing it.
Yeah.
Can I ask something? So, if it's possible to target people like on a racial level or like on a sort of like genetically specific target, specific aspects of people, like these different reaction of people, like the death rate with regard to these lots or batches. Could it also be that it's a certain, you know, that this would also be like an effect of like targeting people for some specific genetic aspect, or is that too far-fetched?
Well, I think that I personally think that what those studies show about the toxicity versus the lot are really, they've changed something as time has gone on, whatever they've changed to try and make it less toxic. It doesn't mean that it won't be damaging long-term, but they don't want the short-term toxicity because they don't want to get caught. It's kind of like the binary poison. You want the guy to die when you're far away from him, right? So I think there's a certain amount of that. But I will tell you this, that when this thing first started being talked about and this vaccine started rolling out, a friend of mine from Philadelphia sent me this paper, and it's in PubMed, you can find it. I've got it on my site. And it's talking about the racial specificity of the ACE2 pathway. And you know, that's where the spike protein hooks on, is to the human ACE2 pathway, which we don't have any coronavirus anyplace else that does this. SARS didn't do it. MERS didn't do it. Just this one. So I think maybe SARS did it, but it didn't. It wasn't any other pathway. So any other coronavirus. So this thing was designed with this hook to get it in the ACE2 pathway. And if you look at the ACE2 pathway upregulation, in other words, how active that pathway, just like insulin receptors are active, the ACE2 receptors are active or not so active, it is racially different. Now, I'm not making any judgment here. I'm not telling you what this means. I'm just going to tell you the facts. If you look at that paper, the people that have the most upregulation of the ACE2 pathway, because some of this is kind of surprising, are white Caucasians from Europe, excepting Finns, not Finnish. And it's about 56% upregulated in those people, as well as in non-African Blacks, 56% upregulation of the ACE2 pathway. Then it drops down to 39% in African Blacks. And then it drops way down to 10% upregulation in Asians and Finnish. I mean, I thought that was kind of surprising. Who knew that the Finnish are genetically not the same as everybody else in Europe, but they have some genetic differences apparently. And then it drops down to zero. And the zero upregulation are two groups, the Amish and the Ashkenazi Jews. There it is. I mean, I'm throwing that out. You can just, that's the fact. And I, you know, the point being that it's coincidental somehow that there's this going on, but I don't see that, you know, I can't marry that up with the VAERS damage report. You know, I don't have a way of doing that, and I don't see a trend there. I'm just saying that's what it. But beyond that, when we look at EMF, what we do know is that everybody's DNA has an energy signal. I mean, it has a specific resonance. DNA has a resonance. You know, when 5G was developed, it was developed by DARPA, and I think Technion was part of this, but I could be wrong. But DARPA definitely, and it was a directed energy weapon, and we used it in Iraq to target. It's a denial of access weapon. In other words, if you set it up with the right frequencies, microwave frequencies at the right gain, right power, what happens is you can resonate with people's helical structures. You can resonate with DNA, but in this case, they resonated with, made a resonant frequency to your hair follicle, which is also helical. And what it did was cause people to have to flee because it made them feel like they were on fire. I mean, we had some troops that got caught in these beams when they put it out, and they said, you cannot stand in this beam. It's terrible, terrible stuff. You have to get out of it. Now, I just bring this up because, again, I don't think everything is about this man-made nanotoxic or nanoparticle that's toxic. I think there are other things going on here, and there's a lot of evidence about this electrification making people sick over history. But specifically, I think we need to be cognizant of this 5G potential directed energy weapon that once it's in place and it's you know, on every tree in the forest and every lamppost around our communities, it's potentially could be used to target human beings as an individual, not just in a group. So we might be looking at this. I mean, this is my big, you know, my military hat thinking, not that I'm any kind of military genius, but I'm just thinking about what they've been doing, because we've had 200 Chinese scientists embedded in Moderna and Pfizer to help roll out these so-called vaccines, these genetic agents, viral-based genetic therapies. Apparently, the whole military, Department of Medicine is not concerned this could be a bioweapon in spite of that fact. In spite of that, that's their job to be a little bit concerned about this. And they're vaccinating people like pilots. Even after 9 civilian pilots are dead, one in the cockpit, we continue to vaccinate pilots in the military. These guys aren't carrying people, man. They're carrying armaments, including nuclear armaments, okay? And yet we are breaking every military, maxim of safety for pilot safety. I mean, I was never a flight surgeon, but I was with the Marine Corps for 2 years on Marine air bases. And those flight surgeons would never, ever, ever give an experimental drug to these guys. In fact, they wouldn't even give an FDA approved drug that hadn't been on the market for about 5 years. So what is this really all about? If we have 70% of our look at the disability that happened in the Navy, the Australian Navy, when they were vaccinated and ships were now not deployable. How many people were not deployable? Our military's in trouble, I think, if they really did take this vaccine as stated. If they got the same vaccine we are all getting and the same numbers apply and that myocarditis thing I cited is real and it continues, I mean, what is going on here? And that nobody suspected. And I will tell you, I did have the opportunity to sit with Scott Atlas, who was at dinner, who was President Trump's medical advisor. And I think he's a good guy and on our side. But you know what? I asked him two questions. I said, did anybody from military medicine ever come and talk to you or advise President Trump? This is the commander in chief of our military. And the answer was no. Did anybody from Fort Detrick ever come, the bioweapons lab, ever come and advise the president or you? No. You see what I'm saying? There's so many different aspects to this, but I think that there's a huge national security issue. That's what I'll leave you with. This huge national security issue that nobody's screaming about. And I hope it's not too late. And I hope that, you know, the Marine Corps resisted any vaccines for a long time. I give credit to their commandant and the special forces. You know, I don't know about Space Force, but I can tell you the Air Force, Navy, and Army have been pushing these vaccines. In spite of the non-necessity of doing so, they only lost 20 people to COVID over the year of COVID. So something not good is happening here. And by the way, who are the two militaries that are not taking these genetic agents? Give you a guess, Russia and China.
Well, I think it's very good that you point out these military aspects. You know, we haven't looked at that all yet.
This was my first thing.
We have to look at that more in detail. I mean, it's very interesting ideas, and we have to just take a look at it more closely, I guess. I see that Mike Yeadon has joined us in the meantime.
Yeah. Lee, we're going to have to take a much closer look at the 5G issue. I have a number of colleagues here in Germany who have been working on this. They haven't come to a definite conclusion yet, but they realize, and we realize, having spoken to them, that this is a very serious issue. Serious issue. And I think it was not for nothing that at the beginning of this crisis in Great Britain and in other places, but in Great Britain in particular, people destroyed the antennas. I think they did the right thing.
I think so too.
Okay.
And I will just leave you. There's an excellent video by Dr. Devra, and I apologize, I don't know her first name, but she gave a lecture a number of years ago to the combined departments of engineering and medicine at Melbourne University. It's still online, you know, hopefully. It's awesome. And she was, I believe, the chief medical officer of the EPA at one time. So she's not a lightweight, and she did some excellent points on the issue of electromagnetic frequency cellular irradiation damage, shows you case reports, and explains how they use the same. The telecommunications industry is the same. They're indemnified from all medical consequences, and they're using the same arguments that, this is not unsafe, just like they did for the cigarette industry, and that's what got her interested in this. So I would recommend people look at that if they want to get an introduction into this.
What's her name again?
Devra, D-E-V-R-A.
Okay.
V as in victory, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
This was very enlightening. It was fun too, despite the fact that we're dealing with horrific horror stories here. But we have all come to the conclusion that this is the one upside. I have felt for a number of years when I went to court in order to go after Deutsche Bank and all the others, I have felt that there's something wrong. And all of a sudden, everything falls into place. We're beginning to understand that we've been seriously lied to concerning almost
everything.
Single aspect of our lives.
Yeah. And that's the good news, because we can deny reality, but you can't deny the consequences. So now we're getting a dose of reality, and we're going to take our world back in 2022. And I thank you guys for how much you've done to bring that about.
I have just one question. You mentioned a book which was taken out of the dustbin and published.
Oh, yeah.
What was it?
Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars.
Thank you.
Enlightening. It's worthwhile reading. It's a very, very small book, but I would definitely read that one.
I got that. Okay. Well, thank you, Lee. Have a great weekend. If you like,
thank you.
Around.